This is reel one of two reels interviewing Mrs. Winifred Coghill of Nenana, the mother of John B., Jack Coghill, Bob Coghill, and Colonel Bill Coghill. Interviewer is Mike Dalton of Fairbanks, Tewksbury, who is referred to in this tape. Tewksbury is Mrs. Coghill's poodle. Today I'm at the home of Mrs. Winifred Coghill in Nenana, Alaska. And Mrs. Coghill is the mother of John B. Jack Coghill and Bob Coghill and Bill. Bill is Colonel Bill now. And where is he now?
Bill is now stationed at Fort Richardson in Alaska. And he's the controller for the USARAL in Alaska.
The controller?
Yeah, controller for the United States Army in Alaska. And he is a graduate, of course, of West Point and Harvard. And he was in the cavalry. And when he went over to, after he finished his assignment, he was in Japan at the time of the Korean break, and he was the one with the first army that went over as a reconnaissance to Korea. And he had only been there, I think, about 6 weeks when he had his knee blown off. He was he volunteered to go to see where these snipers were, because they'd been blowing up all their trucks. So they sent a truck ahead to see where the snipers was coming from. And the truck went by, but apparently they saw his little jeep coming, so he got the full force of a machine gun, and it blew his knee clean off, and his driver saved his life by taking him back to the first aid. Then he was brought, of course, then he went to Tokyo and had the amputation and was there on the critical list for 3 months before they finally managed to get him in condition to go to Walter Reed. Then, of course, he was there for 3 or 4 years.
Did he lose his entire knee?
Or? Oh, he lost his leg. And he has
his entire leg?
Yeah, he has a very short stump he has.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, so now he's wearing a wooden leg. And so
then, and he's still in the active service.
Oh, yes, he didn't want to be discharged. He says, I've been West Point trained and I've got a good brain, and he says, this doesn't hurt my brain. But it was no use any longer in the cavalry, so he transferred to finance. So they put him through finance school, and then he went to Harvard and graduated from Harvard. And
From the Harvard Business School.
Yes, and then he went down to spend a while in the Pentagon, and he went down to Fort Riley. And he graduated down there from what they call the Army General College. Mm-hmm. And finally went back to the Pentagon, graduated from the Army War College. Mm-hmm. So he's had lots of education, and now, as I say, he is the finance controller in Alaska.
It surprises me that to hear that a career officer would be that have such a serious wound and still be in the service. Yes. I've just never heard of that before.
Well, as he said, he didn't just want to leave the Army. He figured that the West Point had trained him, and his brain was still as good as ever. And he has made good. Mm-hmm. And I know I talked to all the commanding officers down that he's been under, of all highly recommended him as a very, a good worker and very conscientious and thorough in his work. And in fact, I think he's considered down there as the number one man. And I know General Gettys said he was very fond of Bill, a good boy.
So your son Bill then is at Fort Richardson. Mm-hmm. And your son Jack?
Well, Bob is the second.
Bob is the second.
And he's the manager of the Coghill's Corporation
store.
Right now.
Coghill Corporation.
Coghill's Corporation, yes. With the three boys and myself are all in the partners in the corporation. but Bob is the manager. Then, of course, Jack is the Union Oil consignee here, besides his other activities.
Besides being mayor of Nenana and chairman of the Republican Party for Alaska.
Right.
What other major duties does he have?
I think they all belong to the Veterans of Foreign Wars
and
the Chamber of Commerce, of course.
That's right, because Jack was the master of
ceremonies. And both, in fact, all three boys are lay readers in the Episcopal Church. So they all help with the services here. And now that we have no resident priests here, we're going to have to be a little more active in taking the services. But Bill has been working with the post chapel down there for Churchison too.
I see. So. You came to Nenana when?
I arrived in Nenana in September of 1919.
And were you married to Mr. Coghill then?
Yes. My husband came over here. I'll have that on the other paper. But we'd known each other in England as young people. So he had planned to come over to back to England. He came over to Canada in 1908 after he was an apprenticed printer and had lived with my folks whilst he was a young man taking his apprenticeship. So when we moved away from that town, and when he got his articles, he decided he was going to Canada. He thought there would be a better future for young men over there. So my mother told him to keep in touch with us. So he did, and all those years, he was a little older than I, of course. And then in 1914, he decided he wanted to come back to England, but the war broke out. And he had only got his first papers taken out, so he didn't risk it. So then that Christmas he wrote to my mother and said he was really coming back for me, that he had told her when I was 9 years old that he was going to come back and fetch me when I was old enough. So he came over in, so we were engaged then in 1914, and then when the war broke out, when the war finished, he came over and in March of 1919, he left Nenana by dog team going through the canyon and till he got to the coast. And so we were married in June 1919, 3 weeks after he arrived. And 3 weeks after that, we were married. And another 3 weeks, I was on my way to Alaska. And we hadn't seen each other for 13 years.
Oh. So. You have compiled some notes here on your husband. If you don't mind, I'll just read them.
Right.
Maybe that'll bring some of the dates up that I'd be interested in. You were asked to compile this, kind of a brief history on Mr. Coghill, so I'm glad someone else asked you to do that because it helps me a great deal. Right. I'll just read it. Right. William Alexander Coghill was born in Shrewsbury, England, on November 28th, 1884. Of Scottish parents. He was raised and educated there, and after completing his training and becoming a journeyman apprentice in 1907, he traveled to Canada, believing that there was a promising future for young people. He had no trouble finding employment and worked his way west, and worked in Vancouver on the Vancouver Sun, and then in Seattle. The urge to explore further in Alaska looked interesting. So he used his money for a passage to Valdez, arriving there in 1908. He walked the whole of the way from Valdez to Fairbanks, stopping at the roadhouses and chopping wood in payment for a bunk and a meal. At Fairbanks, he was employed by William F. Thompson. Wrong front Thompson,
yeah,
they called
right.
him. It was his nickname, wasn't it?
Sure.
William F. Thompson, printing for the old Tanana newspaper, for some time, and then the outdoors called him. So he made a bargain with W.F. Thompson to take the daily newspaper out to the prospectors at Esther Creek. And he walked the distance every day, getting a dollar for each paper. The prospectors were more than glad of this service, and soon he was taking orders for drugs, etc., from them. This developed into a successful express business and he was able to buy a horse and buggy, and he was a familiar figure around Fairbanks, making his rounds at the different banks and business houses. He used to say that his horse knew each place and would stop on his own accord. After some time, he purchased a one-cylinder brush automobile, having it brought up from the States. He was then carrying the sacks of gold dust into the banks, as well as mail and passengers. He used to say that on the outgoing journey, he had to have at least one good passenger, for they would have to get out halfway up Esther Hill and push it up over the top. His honesty and jolly personality made him well-liked, and he was known as the English Kid. Apparently he had an English accent.
He did, very much so.
Being from England. Yes. Her notes continue. At one point he had a financial loss when the bank in which he had his savings failed. But undaunted, he kept going and made good. Plans to return to England to spend Christmas of 1914 visiting his mother and friends were disrupted when the First World War broke out. He was in the process of becoming an American citizen and finally obtained his naturalization papers on January 14, 1918. A new venture in business opened up when he bought into a general store in Enana in 1917. With the commencement of the building of the Alaska Railroad in 1917, the town of Nenana mushroomed quickly, it being the headquarters at the northern end and was a bustling community of about 6,000 people. That surprises me. I had no idea it was that large. Having established a growing business, Mr. Coghill realized his dream of visiting the old country and leaving a competent crew to run the store. He left Nenana in March of 1919, traveling by dog team through the Nenana Canyon to Talkeetna, there taking the railroad to Seward, thence by boat to Seattle, train to New York, ocean liner to Liverpool, arriving there at the end of May. On June 18, 1919, he was married to his old girlfriend, Winifred Fortune, after an engagement lasting 5 years. Winifred was born in Neath, South Wales, of English parents. They returned to Nenana in September 1919 and have made this town their home and raised a family here. The first child, a girl, died in infancy, a victim of the flu epidemic. There are three sons, William Fortune, Robert Alexander, and John Bruce. John Bruce. I often wondered what the B stood for. Now I know. John Bruce Coghill. William was born in
Swansea,
South Wales, England, while his parents were on a visit in 1923, and was brought home to Nenana in March of 1924. He was raised and educated in Nenana and at the University of Alaska. He graduated from West Point Military Academy in 1947, served with the United States Army in Japan and Korea, was wounded in Korea, received the Purple Heart and Silver Star. He transferred to the Army Finance and is a graduate of the Finance School, Harvard Business College, the Army General College, and the War College, and is now a colonel and comptroller for the U.S. Army in Alaska, serving at Fort Richardson, Alaska. He is married and has two sons, William and Thomas. Robert Coghill was born in Nenana, received his education here and at the University of Alaska. He served in the Air Force in World War II. Then he went into partnership with his father at the Nenana business and has been its manager ever since his father died in 1947. He has built up a successful business, overcoming heavy losses by fire and flood disasters. He is married and has two children, Robert Alexander and Marilyn Elaine, both now attending the University of Alaska. John Bruce Jack Coghill was born in Fairbanks, served with the Army in World War II. He is the consignee for the Union Oil Company in Nenana, is very active in politics, has served as representative in the legislature for the Republican Party, and also as senator. At present, he is the state chairman of the Republican Party. Jack is married and has six children, Patricia, John, James, Gerald, Paula, and Jeffrey. Mr. Coghill died in March of 1947. He was a member of the Old Arctic Brotherhood, the Pioneers of Alaska, the Blue Lodge, and Knights Commandery, is it? Knights Commandery of the Scottish Rite, the Tanana chapter of the Masonic Lodge. Well, that was very nice of you to let me read that. That gives kind of a concise introduction to the family.
I wondered whether I should put the girls' names in that they had married. That's probably I should do that.
That would help. I was going to ask Jack's wife, Frances, is an Alaskan. And
that's what I was going to say. She is a what, third generation?
Third generation?
Let's see. Third generation Alaskan.
Mm-hmm. And what was her maiden name?
Her name was Gilbert.
Gilbert.
Frances Gilbert, mm-hmm. Yes.
Could you... Where was she born, in Fairbanks or Nenana or?
I think she was born. I'm pretty sure she was born in Fairbanks because I know she went to school all her life up there.
Mm-hmm. And her parents, were they born in Alaska?
No, I don't think so. Now her grandparents were Nels Peterson, that used to be the operator for the pump station here when the railroad first started. And they were both Swedish, he and his wife, Swedish. And I really don't know whether Francis' mother was born in Alaska or whether they came here. I'm not sure, but I think Francis, I'm pretty sure Francis was born there.
Mm-hmm.
So you see, we've got fifth generation in that family because there's the grandparents and Franny's mother and Franny, and then Patty and her two little children.
Yes.
We've got five generations.
Right. Then Bob Coghill's wife is...
She's from Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. She came up here as a nurse for St. Mark's Mission.
And her name is...
And her name was Gladys Schreiner.
Gladys Schreiner.
Schreiner. S-H-R-I-E-N-E-R. And she came from Philadelphia.
And she was a nurse with the...
She was a nurse with the Episcopal Mission here.
Mm-hmm. And then Colonel Bill Coghill's wife.
His wife was from Chicago. And her name was Geraldine Stevens. And they met whilst Bill was going to West Point.
I see.
Mm-hmm. They were married in Chicago.
Have you counted your grandchildren and great-grandchildren lately?
Yes, I have 10 grandchildren and 2 great-grandchildren.
And the great-grandchildren are?
Patty's. Yes, mm-hmm. That's Jack's.
I saw them here on July 15th when I was here for...
One little redhead.
Yes.
Rascal.
He's a little rascal.
She's really, a girl.
He's cute. It's a girl. Oh, it's a girl.
Two girls, yeah.
Oh. She's a little rascal.
Yes, she
is. She's awfully cute. Very, just at the age when they're into everything.
But real smart.
Yeah.
Very smart.
Good. This outline of Mr. Coghill's that I just read didn't say very much about you. Tell me how you met your husband. Did you meet in England?
Yes. I was only 7 years old at the time. And... Bill from Shrewsbury, he came down to Neath, where we lived,
mm-hmm.
to be apprentice at this printing office. And the head of the printing office was my father's friend. And he told my father that he had a young boy come down as his apprentice. And he said, he's very lonely, he's come from home. And he doesn't want to live in lodgings by himself. And did he know anyone who would take him in as a member of the family? So my father said, well, you know, he would talk to mother because we had a big house. So they brought him to our house one Sunday evening after church. They had met in church. And I say I was 7 years old at the time. And I had gone to bed, of course, after church. But we had a thunderstorm that night, and when I was a child, I was terrified of thunderstorms. And I came running downstairs, not knowing that there was company, but running downstairs to my mother that I was afraid of the thunder, and I burst into the living room where they were and crying. And young Bill was sitting in the chair there, and he said, "Oh, don't be afraid," he says, "it won't hurt you." So he picked me up in his lap and put my head under his coat, and that's the first meeting that we had.
Oh.
Well, then Mother decided she liked him, and so he lived with us for 2 years
mm-hmm.
as a member of the family whilst he was going. And then we moved away from that town, we went to live in Cardigan. So Bill was still going
working as an apprentice.
So then when we left, my mother was very fond of him. She'd accepted him, you know, as mm-hmm. almost another child. And told him to be sure now never to lose touch. So he did. He'd write to Mother. Then after he got his articles, when he wrote to Mother and said that he decided to go to Canada, he says, "Can I come and spend a few days with you before I leave?" So, of course, he did. And that was the last that we saw of him, really. So he kept in touch with us after he came to Canada and, you know, worked all his way, as I say, across. And the next thing we heard that he was in Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
And I can remember him sending me a little gold nugget pin with Alaska written on it, you know, like they used to have. And from there on, I would always have little gifts. But during the time that he lived with us, my mother used to have to send his tea to him at the print office every afternoon. So I can remember me going down the street there with his little tea basket in my hand, taking his pot of tea and his sandwich or whatever it was. And he was always very fond of me then, and always had a little gift for me. Sometimes he'd type a little verse for me, you know, and mm-hmm. let me watch him set the type, you know, by hand. When he left for Canada and used to write to Mother, I used to put little notes in with Mother's mm-hmm. letters. And gradually, friendship, but I had no idea that he told my mother then that he was going to come back for me when I was old enough to be married. So that when the war came on and he was coming home, when he wrote and told Mother that, you know, he would have to wait, and asked if he could write to me to ask if I would be engaged to him, which was a big surprise to me when I got this, because I'd never thought of him as more than a big brother.
Yes.
However, we kept on writing, and as I say, he sent me this. I had this ring on Christmas of 1914. So we were engaged, as I said, 5 years, and I left school and, of course, grew up in the meantime. So when he did come over, it was 13 years since we'd seen each other.
Mm-hmm.
But the arrangement was that if we didn't click, you know, it would be just mutually,
mm-hmm.
dropped. But however, we did, and we had a very happy life together. He was mm-hmm. a wonderful husband and father. And
yeah. He sounds like a
very, very, very jolly,
Tewksbury.
Sort of a, more or less of an outgoing personality like Jack Tewksbury. Come on.
Your son, Jack, you say, has much of the same type of personality
as
your husband. Outgoing.
Very outgoing.
Jolly. And,
yes. Yeah. Bob is very much more reserved. He's more of my type, you know. Mm-hmm. And Bill is different again. I mean, all three of them are different, because Bill has been so well educated. I mean that he's at home in any situation. I mean.
Yes. Mm-hmm. It's unusual to find someone who's, I assume, Jack has lived most of his life right here in Nenana, hasn't he?
Yes, except for the
war years.
Yes, and then he was stationed at Adak, of all places, for a while. And after that, he was sent back here to Nenana. You see, we had troops here guarding the bridge and things like that. So he was right here at home.
It's what I was going to say is that it's unusual to find someone of that,
yes.
with his personality, right. his outgoing nature, and his good nature.
But
he's good natured, and he has a way with people.
Right.
But he's one of my favorite people, really. Right.
But the thing about it is that it amazed me because he was such a poor student in school.
Is that right?
And I couldn't get him to study or do his homework, and he had poor marks, and he wouldn't read.
And now
it was just all of a sudden he took an interest in books. And his memory now is just wonderful. You know, when
it's
he was
phenomenal,
you know, when he was in the legislature, yes, he could quote you. But I always used to say I never understood just what caused that sudden interest in learning and books. And then, of course, he had to finish his high school after he came out of the army. In fact, he and Franny, both of them, finished after they were married.
Oh, is that right?
6 months. I don't know how many credits or something. Anyway, they took the course together and finished.
Yeah. That's but interesting. And then he went on to the University of Alaska?
Jack didn't. No,
Jack didn't.
No, he just only 8th grade, that's all. I mean, high school.
Mm-hmm.
No, he... When they came back from the war, after being out of it, you know, for 3-4 years, now Bob was supposed to go back to the university, but he said he didn't feel like going back to study, so he wanted to go in with his dad. And it was a fortunate thing that he did, because he only had less than a year to work with his dad. You see, when Bill was going to West Point in the fall of 1946, Bill said, let's go out and see Bill. And I said, well, why go out now when we're going for his graduation in June of next year? No, his dad says, I just want to see Bill. I said, let's go out, and he can't come home for a visit, we'll go out and visit him. So we had a friend that had a beautiful ranch home up in Hanover, New Hampshire, that had invited us to come there and have Bill come, so we'd all spend our time there together. And she was the head of the lab there at the hospital, so she sort of persuaded my husband and I both to go through the clinic whilst we were there. And then we found out that Bill had a little high blood pressure. It hadn't bothered him much before, you know. So he was told then that he'd better, you know, go a little bit easier. And the sad thing about it was that he had a heart attack and died 6 weeks before Bill graduated from West Point. And he'd already given him his car, you know, for graduation, and we were all looking forward to it. And then suddenly one afternoon, he had been going slower, you know, and Bob had been working with him, you see, since the previous summer.
Yes.
And getting to know how to run the business, which was rather small in those days. So when I came home this Saturday afternoon, and my husband was laying on the couch, and I said, you don't feel very well. And he says, no, he said, I got indigestion or something. And I went out to put on some water to get him some tea or something. And when I came back, he was purple in the face and gasping, and he was gone.
That was in 1947?
That was in March of 1947.
How fortunate that you did go to West Point to visit.
Right, he must have had maybe a presentiment or something.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
But Bill always said that, you know, that it was so good that, you know, he had been able to see him.
Yeah. Then the Coghill Corporation, that you, the four of you, your three sons are members of that. Does that include the store and the Union Oil
distributorship? No, the Union Oil is absolutely separate.
It's separate.
Yes. Mm-hmm. No, you see, when his dad died, Bob and his dad were going to go in as father and son, and the others were not, you know. And of course, I was just working there, you know. So then when his dad died, I said to the boys, now what do you want to do with the business? Shall we sell the business? Because Bill was going on with his career in West Point, and I wanted him to go back to the university. And Jack was very interested in flying at the time, and was taking, of course, in flying, and he wanted to go out to a school for aviation mechanics, you know, so that he would know how to take care of a plane. So then, of course, when we got together after Daddy was buried, the boys didn't want the business to go. So Bob and Jack both thought that they would work together with me in the business, and we tried that for a while, and And then Jack got this offer of the Union Oil just shortly afterward. So we went on that way for a while, and then we decided we'd better make a corporation of it, with Bob and I the only working partners, but the others, you know, had their interest in it.
Yes.
So that's the way we have operated. Of course, Bob has everything on his shoulders. You know, he's the one that's carrying the load.
But you work there every day.
I work there too, yes. Mm-hmm. And I really am president of the organization, but actually, we always have to have our yearly meetings, you know, and as a regular corporation and decide on policies and everything. Mm-hmm. But I have taken quite a lot of the bookkeeping off Bob's shoulders, because I had done bookkeeping before I got married. Mm-hmm.
Now, before you were married, let's go back to England. When you finished your schooling, did you said you did some bookkeeping before you were married.
Well,
where did you work?
I went to work on the railroad in the freight office there. My father was on the railroad. He was what we called station masters in those days. It was like a depot agent, you might say. And then he was the superintendent of the Great Western end of the South Wales section of the Great Western Railway. So when the war broke out and they were taking girls on, I'd always wanted to work with figures, but I had to wait a while because they weren't taking girls on until I finally got a place there. So I worked for 4 years in the freight office there.
Mm-hmm. You did accounting and bookkeeping.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And when I went to work in the office there, there was only three others besides myself. But after I'd been there 2 or 3 months, the Nobel Company opened up a shell filling plant right where we lived. See, we lived in this coal mining community. We had all these 7 collieries there, which we were shipping coal all the time, you know. So the shell filling factory opened up. So, of course, our time, in 3 or 4 months, we had 16 or 20 people right there in the office. You see, because the war accelerated all this business. And it was very interesting because I always have enjoyed working with books.
This is Reel 2 of 2 Reels interviewing Mrs. Winifred Coghill in Nenana, Alaska, in early summer 1973. And you worked as a bookkeeper in England, first for the... You stayed with the railroad then until you came to Nenana. You arrived here in 1919. Tell me about your trip to Nenana. You left England and...
We left England
traveled by ship, naturally.
From Liverpool.
Mm-hmm.
And it took us 10 days crossing the Atlantic. We had to... we had about 2,000 troops on board that were being returned to Canada. So we had to stop at Halifax whilst they discharged all these troops. Then we went down into New York and we visited with some old friends and bills from Fairbanks that lived out there at the time by the name of Flashman, the old Flashman family that were well known in Fairbanks. So we stayed with them for a week. And it was by then August. And it was pretty hot, and I was travelling in my English tweed, Harris tweed suit, you know. I wasn't really dressed for American weather at all. But anyway, when it took us then 4 days and 3 nights to cross the States by train, and that was an awful hot journey.
Okay. Did you still wear your tweeds?
Well, I had nothing else to wear, but I mean, I had a blouse. And it was an awful dusty trip because there were no air conditioning in those days. And if you opened the windows for a little air, you'd get all the soot and the ashes from the old coal-burning engines. However, we survived the trip and got to Seattle about 6 hours late than what we should have done. And couldn't get a room in a hotel there. We tried one place after another. Mm-hmm. There was a convention going on there, so finally he left me in the lobby of one of the hotels while he and a taxi driver went traveling around to see if they couldn't find a place, and finally got a place in the old Grand Hotel, which was a bridal suite of four rooms that we had to take for one night because that was the only thing they had. And the next day, of course, we were moved into a regular room. So then we visited around with several friends, and also the business people that Bill had been doing business with. Everybody wanted to entertain us, you know. And I was a little bit of an oddity, I think, being a little English bride. And my husband used to have a great kick about introducing me. He says, I've married a misfortune, so he says, we don't know what we're going to make of her, or something like that.
That's a good joke.
So then we left Seattle by boat up to Skagway by the Inside Passage. And that was a beautiful, beautiful trip. I surely did enjoy that. And I can remember writing home reams of letters describing the wonderful scenery and the strange people that I thought I had met, you know.
Yes.
Then from Skagway, of course, we went by White Pass Yukon Railway to Whitehorse. And we spent 2 days in Whitehorse waiting for the boat connection. Then we went by boat from Whitehorse to Dawson, and we missed the connection for Nenana by 2 hours. So we had to sit and wait for 2 weeks for the boat to come to Nenana and back again. And by that time it was getting late. My husband was getting a little bit worried about the ice running. So we arrived on the last boat of the season at the end of September.
That was the Stern Wheeler.
And that was the old
Tanana.
From Tanana we got the old Tanana. So we went from Dawson, of course, to Tanana in one of the Canadian boats, and then we got the old Tanana from
the Tanana from Dawson.
Yes, Tanana from
the village of Tanana.
Yeah, from Tanana. Yeah.
Do you remember the name of the Stern Wheeler that you came down from Dawson?
No, I can't remember that. I was trying to think, but I can't remember that.
And when you arrived in Nenana, that was in September of 1919. What was here
in Nenana? 27th or 28th, I think it was. Well, it was quite a bustling town, of course. You see, they had all these people here. And it was a beautifully clean, brand new town. All the buildings were new, and they were nearly all painted with this green and white. And we had sidewalks, wooden sidewalks, mm-hmm. all the way practically from as far as the depot, almost as far as the FAA now. Buildings on both sides of the streets, and all the way up here, out to the mission was the end out here. And there were an awful lot of workmen, of course, because that was the stage of the railroad, was digging the roadbed first, mm-hmm. you know, and putting the spikes. And there was there were about 400 Russians here that were doing the hard digging work. And, of course, we had the store, and the store was open all 24 hours then, and it was more of a sort of a community gathering place as well as a store, because they'd come in there and we'd have the soft drink fountain and ice cream, because no liquor in those days. And they liked to come in and visit. So when we were in Seattle, Bill had brought one of these punch boards up with him. Do you know what they were? They were these cardboard things that you'd punch little numbers out of, and you'd get a prize if you got the number, you know, that had a prize. And this was all boxes of chocolates for prizes, you know. Yeah. It was a novelty, and he thought, you know, he'd put it in the store. So one evening, an old group of these Russians came in and sitting up in the stools, and I was there, you know, behind the counter helping. And it was kind of interesting, you know, meeting these different people. So these old Russians, one of them wanted to know what that was, so they started punching. And, of course, that was a novelty, so they didn't stop until they'd punched every hole out of it. And, of course, the winners had their boxes of chocolates, and I think there must have been maybe a dozen boxes of chocolates that were prizes. So when they got through, one of the old Russians, he says to me, Mrs. Coggin, will you have my box of chocolates? Because I don't eat chocolates, you know. And if they didn't all come and give me all those boxes of chocolates back in here, I had all their money for their punches and their chocolates as well. But I had... got the I sign for my husband to accept, you know. So he told me, I said, that was an awful thing to do. No, no, he said, if you hadn't, they would have been offended. And he said they didn't want the chocolates. They had the fun of having paying you for the punches, and that was their fun. But he said they would have been offended if you hadn't accepted. And so
what did you do with the 12 boxes?
That I don't remember, but I know I didn't eat them. Probably gave them away, you know, to friends.
But Ninana, at that time, in 1919, Ninana was the headquarters for the northern construction of the railroad.
Right, and we had the commissary here, the meat market, the dormitories, the hospital, and the offices. The main offices were all here. And the roundhouse for the pump house, and the roundhouse for the train. And whilst the railroad was being constructed, there was a narrow gauge track from North Ninana to Fairbanks.
North Ninana, you mean?
Ninana is at the end of where the traffic bridge is now.
On the other side.
Yeah, on the other side of the river, which is called North Ninana.
Mm-hmm.
So, going to Fairbanks, you could get across the river by boat to catch the single track train. And in the winter time, they would lay the rails on the ice, and the train would come right to this side, you see, and then you take the train from there. Then, of course, whilst they were building the bridge, they were changing the narrow to the regular standard gauge, so that when the railroad bridge was completed in 1923, which was, you know, our celebration for the Golden Spike, then you were able to go right through
to Fairbanks. So the bridge was being completed, they were also widening the track.
They were in the process of it. Now, my husband and I were on the first passenger train that ever went across the bridge.
When was that, 1923?
That was in 1923. We had gone to Fairbanks across the river for some reason or other, I can't remember what, and were there for several days, and it was that time that they ran the first passenger train back through here, so we were on that first passenger train.
But when when President Harding came up in July of 1923, were you here for the ceremony?
No, I wasn't here for that, because we came across the bridge. It was early, and it was in March. It was long before the, because I went to England in April, you see. We had lost our first little girl, you see. So then when I found out that Bill was coming, my doctor said, why don't you go back and visit your mother? Because I hadn't been in very good health. And in the meantime, we had gone, in the first 18 months that I was up here, we had experienced everything in the book. Because we'd had the flu epidemic, my husband almost died with that, and we had a fire almost burned up the store, and then we had an earthquake and a flood, all in that first 18 months.
And a flood too?
Yes.
And was it
not a big, big flood, but it was enough to bring it into the store in about 2 feet.
And was it the flu that took your little girl?
Yes, she was born in 1920. And was all right for 6 months. She was pretty healthy at 6 months. But then this second surge of flu, and she got pneumonia, and I had her in the hospital for 5 months. But she just didn't recover.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then it was during the time that she was very ill that I woke up one night and found the end of the building all in flames. And we managed to get out. And then
did you live in the same building?
We lived upstairs, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And we were living in the front part of the house, and the fire had started in the back. Our night watchman apparently had fixed the furnace and gone off for a cup of coffee, and it was 44 below that night, and forgotten to turn the drafts off, and was gone. And of course the wooden buildings, you know, with the hot pipe were started, and I had heard this crackling in our bedroom, and I opened the door, and Yeah, I could see the whole back end of the house in flames.
So did the entire structure
burn? No, they saved it halfway. It was a large, must have been 100 feet back, you see. Mm-hmm. But it was, it burned, say, two rooms through, but it was repaired, but they did save it. And then that spring, as I say, we had high water, and then we didn't have a big earthquake, but it was enough to scare me because it shook everything I had upstairs under the floor. So then, a couple of years later, when I found out that Bill Eisen, the doctor had said, you better have another child, and I said, no, you know, that experience I didn't want to go through again. However, when he was coming, why, I went back home in April and stayed, you know, with my folks. And Bill was born there in July. And he's never forgiven me for that, of all the troubles that he's had to go through when he went to West Point to declare himself a citizen.
Course, yes.
So then that Christmas Bill came over and spent 6 weeks, and then we came back. And when Bill was a year old, Bill was, he was born July, and we came back in February. It's about 8 months, 9 months old when we got home. But when he went to West Point, you know,
that he had to prove that he was a United States citizen.
But I had gone to the authorities in England and asked them for a certificate, you know. I had his birth certificate, but I wanted a certificate saying that he was an American citizen, born of American parents.
Had you received your naturalization?
Well, I was married before the law went into effect, you see.
So I was automatically an American citizen when
we got married. But they said, no, there's no question about it. There's nothing we can give you. He is an American citizen. He's born of American parents. Do you think the West Point people would accept that? No, sir. So I finally got Delegate Diamond, who was a friend of ours, and who was the one that was... That had,
is that Tony Diamond?
Yes, mm-hmm. That had recommended Bill, you see, for West Point. So he went to the immigration authorities back there in Washington, and I don't know how anyway he managed to straighten the affair out there for them, you know. And I had even written to the judge in Fairbanks asking for citizenship papers for Bill, and he said, I can't give them to you, there's nothing I can give you.
Mm-hmm.
You can't give a citizenship paper at all when he's already a citizen. Well, you know, the strange thing about this came up again last year.
Again?
Bill was going to Japan for a vacation with his wife. This spring, anyway. He wanted to get he travels on his army passport, but he wanted to get a civilian passport because he said if something should happen over there, that they couldn't come back by military plane, he would have to have a regular passport to come back out of the country. So he applied for one. And they wouldn't accept his army record and they wouldn't accept anything. You know, so we had to go through that whole performance again. I had to find out, I had to come up with our marriage certificate, Bill's birth certificate, and his... baptismal record here and his confirmation record, you know, from the church to show that he had lived, you know, all his life here, was educated. And then I had to write a thesis for and have it
certified
mm-hmm. and given all these facts and everything. And he had to present all this. They finally gave it to him. So then when that was over, he says, I've done with all this nonsense. Now I'm going to the court, he says, and I am going to have them give me a certificate, you know, of his
establishing
that he is. So now, when he went back for them, they showed him all this. He says, no problem at all. Give it to him. There you go.
Yeah.
So now he says, if ever that question ever comes up again, he says, I'm all right.
Yeah.
But
he has had some problems.
Yeah. But,
so you were in England. It was July of 1923. When President Harding came here to New York to drive the Golden
But
Spike.
I was in England that summer. I was there from April until the following February.
Mm-hmm. So Bill came back to Alaska in 1924, just as 7 or 8 months old.
Yeah, right, yeah, mm-hmm. yeah.
To get back to Nenana, when you arrived, you came, was it, let's see, you arrived here on the last boat in September. So the it trees were all yellow, or had the, were there still some yellow leaves
on
the trees?
No, it was a nice fall, yes, mm-hmm. very nice fall. Now, we had friends that had been looking after the store for Bill, had got a log cabin rented for us to go to live in, you see. And, of course, I didn't know a soul in the world outside of my husband, and I had a little difficulty understanding some of the people, and there was a little Italian lady here that was very friendly, and her husband was working for Bill. And she was very good to me, you know, and did a lot, you know, to help me and all that. But, oh, I used to have such a terrible time trying to understand her speaking.
She probably spoke very broken English.
Yeah, I mean, she was, yes. Anyway, we lived up there for, well, by Christmas time, the thermometer dropped to minus 72 degrees.
Oh, my goodness.
And we almost froze, because it was just a little cabin with a door and a window in each room, the four rooms there, and just little tiny stoves, and you couldn't possibly keep the place warm, and it was so far up the street. And I used to get very lonesome, because Bill often didn't get home till 2 or 3 o'clock at night, you know. And so he said, well, why don't we just fixed up an apartment up over the store. It was a two-story building, you see, because they had steam heat down there.
Oh, yes.
And it would have been so much, you know, and I was there, and I wanted to help in the store.
Yes.
So that's what we did. We just moved, we fixed up this apartment over the store, and that's where we lived until, as I say, we got burned out in 1936. We lost everything we had in 1936.
So you had a second fire.
So we had a real fire that time. The whole town, I mean, there were 15 buildings burned up in an hour and a half. It started from the corner, just about where, opposite where our store is now.
Mm-hmm.
Started in a restaurant. They had an explosion or something, and we were in the middle of the block. And whilst we moved a lot of stuff out, why, we couldn't possibly see. The fire department there, there was an awful wind blowing up from the north. Tookie! And there wasn't anything they could do with a big fire like that, so we lost everything we had. But anyway, we had a carload of groceries on the way from Anchorage. So we bought a little building on the spot where our store is now, which had been gutted, partly gutted, but enough to just fix it up temporarily. Well, we weren't going to stay in Nenana, we were going to move to Fairbanks. Bill had two offers to go into partnership with people up there. In fact, they wanted him to go into the old Pioneer Hotel, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't think much of that idea. But anyway, so we fixed that little place up so that we could have groceries for the town, you see, because...
You were the only grocery store?
No, we weren't the only ones. The NC was here, and there's a couple of others, but there was still a need, you know, for that. That was in 1936. And then, that winter, why, the construction of the FAA field started. So that gave Nenana another little boost. Because after the railroad was complete, the bridge was completed, they began taking, of course, all these railroad buildings away. There was, no, you know, because Fairbanks then was naturally the terminus for the north, and Anchorage for the south. So that Nenana was gradually stripped of all these buildings and left us with no economy to for the year round for people to live on.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing was then were the trappers. Of course, we supplied all the trappers, you know, for fur trappers, and we bought all the raw furs, and of course this was the headquarters then for the mail teams in the early days, when they'd have all these big mail teams running with their 18, 20 dogs,
yes.
You know, and It was really a supply store.
This was headquarters.
Yes, this was headquarters for that. This was, I mean, before the railroad, because there was no planes then. Everything was dog team. So that's where he gets a little bit of asthma once in a while.
Come on, get a book.
There, you don't have to get there. That lady doesn't want you. So Nidana went down from his population to a very small handful, you see.
As soon as the railroad was completed, it just happened very rapidly.
Yeah, well, I mean, within the next, say, 6 or 8 years, gradually things got taken away.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had quite a lot of disastrous fires, because all these old buildings had been just put up with just local lumber. And some of them were torn down, some of them were, as I say, just fired. And then the NC finally decided that they would get out, so it was a case of us buying them or them buying us. And they were closing out their smaller posts, you know, at the time. So we bought the NC out. So then we were we've been the only store now, you know, for years.
That would be a little bit later than that, probably about
1940, I would say.
About 1940.
So then in 1948, we managed with this little bit of a store. So then we built an addition. Bob says if we are going to stay in business, we're going to have to do more than just stay in this little place. Because, well, of course, at the time the war was on, you couldn't buy lumber or anything to start anything new. But when he got back, so then we built the section of the store that's further closest to the depot end, you know. You notice we have the posts in the middle.
Yes.
So we built that one side.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a flood there in 48 that almost washed the little place away that we were in. So we built this one section on.
Mm-hmm.
And then as things, you know, got a little more prosperous and we needed a different sort of a clientele, then you see it was different. You weren't supplying all these old trappers and all these sacks of beans and all that sort of thing. It was more of a supermarket trade.
Yeah.
So then we built this other addition on the side, and when it was completed we took the partition out in between. So that gives us, now we put big warehouses on the back.
Yeah.
So that
so you have practically have a supermarket.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And of course we carry, and then of course we have the propane business all the way from here to all the way down the river. We ship thousands of tanks of propane through the store, you know,
mm-hmm.
every summer down river.
Do you do a lot of downriver business now, other than the propane grocery business?
No, very little, no.
Mm-hmm.
Most of that now is done by plane, I think.
Mm-hmm. But back to Nenana in the early days when you came here, the railroad was being built, and then it was completed in 1923, and gradually Nenana's population drifted away, and the railroad buildings were taken away. Some of the temporary construction buildings.
Well, we still had the river business, of course, then.
Still had the river business
and there was passenger boats as well as freight on the river
then.
Well,
you must have then had a hotel and a restaurant.
Oh, we had, in the early days, how many hotels did we have here? We had about six. We had three big ones.
Three big hotels.
And then smaller rooming houses and in the early days.
Then after the completion of the railroad,
they gradually closed down.
People is there moved a hotel away. Here today?
Where there's
right in the town of Nevada?
Not exactly a hotel, but there's rooming houses, you know, there's the apartment house.
Mm-hmm.
And then of course Jack had this Tortella Lodge of his, which was used to be, you know, mostly a rooming house, and then that was badly hit during the flood. So now he's turned it into apartments, and he has, you know, just living apartments rather than rooms.
Isn't there a washateria in there too?
Yeah, yes.
I remember stopping in there some years ago,
uh-huh.
and when we would drive from Fairbanks to Nenana, we'd have to take the ferry across.
Right.
And my husband and I came down. I think we stopped in to see Mary Peterson. Was she here then?
She was running the Peterson Apartments. That's right opposite Jack's Lodge on Lake Scotland.
Then we went across and had some lunch and visited with Jack. But you talked about the Nenana was the headquarters for the dog, the mail carriers.
Who traveled by dog team. Yes.
Talk about that a little bit. How many lived here and how much mail did they carry?
I think they had three different mail outfits, you know. There was old Mike Cooney that had his, they had a big hotelier and his wife ran the hotel, but he ran the mail and they'd go out to McGrath.
What was his name? Mike Cooney?
Cooney, yes.
C-O-O-N-E-Y.
C-O-O-N-E-Y. Yeah. And then there was, there were two others, and I don't really remember their names, but they would take all the mail. How did it come here? I guess the mail
came
up the river.
Came by railroad.
Oh, no, that was before the railroad.
Before the railroad.
It came up on the river, you see.
Yes.
And they would take it to the outlying places, you know, out Tullabhanna Way and McGrath. And they would have, they'd hitch up 20 dogs at a time, and it was a real pretty sight to see them leaving because they'd have these long sledge, you know, pack all the mail up and they'd rope it all down and they'd take off and they all looked nice. And I can remember when I, just after I'd been a little while, and my husband said, one of the mail teams wants 4 dozen dog moccasins. I want you to make 4 dozen dog moccasins. And I said, I never seen a dog moccasin in my life. What does it look like and what are they? So they showed me how to make them, at least give me an idea. And I would take strips of canvas, sail canvas, you know, and stitch them down in a straight line with a little fold over at the back where the heel, where the little foot would go. And then they put them up their legs and tie them around with tapes. And when they were crossing the ice, you see, it would cut the pads of the dog's feet. So when they'd get over an ice, and especially when they'd go over these lakes, frozen lakes or rivers that had choppy places, it would protect their feet from getting cut.
So the driver would put the dog moccasins on.
Just imagine moccasining up 20
dogs.
Anyway, they used to do it because I used to make dozens of those things.
But that was just not for warmth, but to protect
not for
them
warmth,
from the
but for
ice.
Protection. Oh yes, they didn't
the
need the warmth,
ice.
But so that their pads wouldn't get, you know, cut, lacerated.
That must have been a sight to see because most dogs, if you put something on their foot, then immediately they want to take it off.
Well, I suppose these dogs had been trained, or in fact, all the male dogs would have had to be trained, you know, to be able to run. And they would raise them specially as puppies and have them trained. Well, just like they do now for the hunting, you know, for the racing dogs.
So a man who ran a dog team with 20 dogs would probably have to have a kennel of 40 or 50 dogs, wouldn't
he? Yeah, they had a kennel right across where we used to live when I first came up here, you know, with all these dogs yowling and screaming all night. And of course, when one starts howling, you know how they all do, they all join the chorus. I used to get pretty scared, you know, but there was no danger, of course, because they were outside, but all that noise going on and so many strange noises that I had to get used to up here, you know, with it.
That was quite a cultural shock to you, I imagine, coming from a town in England to a raw frontier town in Alaska.
Yes, it was pioneering, very much so in those days.
Well, the other... this Mike Cooney used to carry the mail toward McGrath, and probably another carrier would go toward Tananaw, down the river.
Yes. They'd have their different... I really don't remember too much about that, because I was young, and when you come up to this new country, you know, you don't absorb these things at the time.
Yes.
And you wish later on that you had... paid more attention, you know, to what was going on around
you. Do you recall the flu epidemic when they carried, was it the flu epidemic in Nome, when they carried serum to Nome? Do you recall who might have carried the The carriage didn't